So we're studying the book of 1 Corinthians, and this is the third week. And we spent last week showing the unity between Paul, Apollos, and Peter. And we also need to remember that included in the statement of I follow Paul, I follow Peter, and I follow Apollos was I follow Messiah, as if Messiah's message was somehow different from that of his emissary, Paul. Paul will again deal with this in chapter 3 or 4, and what it should have shown us is that there's pride that's entered into the congregation in Corinth, particularly when we read, I follow Messiah. And in the statement, I follow Apollos, we may see a tendency of the Greeks to be attracted to rhetoric. We were told in Acts that Apollos was a learned man, powerful orator, and we're finding for certain that there is division due to varied teachings in Corinth. The other thing I dealt with in week one was Corinth itself. It was a Roman city with temples to the gods of Rome and Greece as well as others. Some of the temples that we found there were the temple of Apollo, the temple of Aphrodite, the temple of Hermes, Venus, Fortuna, Isis, Poseidon, and a pantheon, which was a temple to all the Roman gods, as well as temples for Demeter and Kor. And in Corinth, we could find cults of the gods of Egypt. Egypt because Alexandria, like Corinth, was a port city. In the letter to the Corinthians, Paul addresses the problems of the temples, and he'll discuss things like sexual immorality of the temple of Aphrodite and others. He'll discuss idolatry because of all the gods and idols in the city, food offered to idols because of all the temples and the unclean food that was sacrificed there. Here's the point. Most of the people that are being witnessed to in Corinth are poor and former pagan. And they have no understanding of the God of Israel or his Torah, and so they're being influenced by a lot of different things. So along with all of these obvious problems, then he will go on to address foundational truths of the faith, the Messiah, all of the things foundational in Messiah. And all of the things he addresses, things like the message of the cross, his death on the stake, his resurrection of the Messiah, and the resurrection in general. And as we know, there's nothing more important to finding eternal life than the death and resurrection of Messiah. And he will address spiritual gifts, the last trump, things we learn as babes in the Lord. And so what I'm trying to get across to you is that these folks are still infants in the Lord, and they are acceptable to erroneous teachings. We find in chapter 3, Paul tells us that flat out. He says, "And I, brothers and sisters, could not speak to you as a spirit-filled, but as worldly. As infants in the Messiah, I gave you milk and not solid food, for you were not yet ready. Indeed, even now you are not yet ready, for you are still worldly. For since there is jealousy and strife among you, aren't you worldly and walking in a human way?" The non-Jews of the Church of Corinth are like children in Messiah. And as children, again, they're susceptible to teachings that are in error. And so Paul is really teaching some of the foundational principles of the faith in the Messiah, Yeshua. And if we move to verse 18, I want to bring something to our attention that may help us understand why he teaches on things like the resurrection. It says this, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the intelligent." And I want you to take note of some words in this passage, foolishness, wisdom, and intelligence, because I want to make you aware of something I think people miss when they're reading the book of Corinthians, and that is in all of Paul's writings, we read the word wisdom a total of 28 times. 17 of those are in 1 Corinthians. And the word for foolishness is the Greek word moria, and it's used 9 times in the writings of Paul. Every one of them in the book of Corinthians. And something that really won't come up until chapter 8 is the word knowledge. And the word for knowledge in the Greek is gnosis. And Paul uses the word a total of 36 times in all of his writings. However, 17 of those are used in the book of 1 Corinthians, in the letters to the Corinthians. And we kind of see it here as he uses the word intelligent. To be intelligent means to have knowledge. And so you may ask yourself, why the focus on knowledge and wisdom to the Corinthians? Well, one of the reasons Paul states plainly in verse 22, he says, "For the Jewish people ask for signs, and the Greek people seek after wisdom. But we proclaim Messiah crucified, a stumbling block to the Jewish people and foolishness to the Gentile people." I think in this letter of Paul, we're witnessing the beginning of something that Paul more than likely has not witnessed before, and it comes from this word gnosis, knowledge. And that's what it will be called later. It will take on the word Gnosticism. Certainly wasn't called that then. But Gnosticism takes the good news and it twists it into something that's really unrecognizable. By the time we get to the second, third, and fourth centuries, the Gnostics will have their own scriptures, even their own gospels. The gospel of Thomas, the gospel of Judas, the gospel of Mary are what are called Gnostic gospels. In 1945, they found copies of these gospels in Nag Hammadi, Egypt. And I just want to give you a brief idea of these gospels because I think we're going to be able to see how these things got popular and entered into. Let's look at the Gospel of Thomas for a minute. It was written around 130 Common Era, and it was supposed to be a collection of Yeshua's sayings. But in all of those sayings, it teaches nothing of the death and the resurrection of the Messiah, because to the Gnostics, that's not what saves you. But it teaches that Messiah came with the knowledge, the gnosis of this fallen world we're in, and how we escape this world. It's that knowledge that brings eternal life. And we see this in the very first verse of the book of Thomas. And it reads this way. "And Christ said, whoever finds the interpretation of these sayings will not taste death." And so, again, it's not Yeshua's death, resurrection, that his sacrifice for you, not his sacrifice, not his being the Passover lamb of God that Paul will cover in chapter 5. No, it's knowledge he gave that saves you. Of course, only a few have that knowledge. However, the worst part of the Gnostic teachings is that they twist biblical texts. And if you would have confronted one of these gentlemen with, "Well, that's not what the text says," they would respond with, "Yeah, but the mystery, the secret knowledge of the text does say that. You just don't see it because you don't have the secret knowledge." We'll speak more of it in chapter 8 because that's where it really comes up, this idea of knowledge. But 1 Corinthians chapter 18, let's read it again. It says, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the intelligent." And as you can see, Paul is not using any secret knowledge here, but a simple message of the cross. And what is the message of the cross? Well, the message of the cross depends on who you ask. One of those understandings tells us why it's foolishness to those who are perishing. You see, nearly every nation used the cross or the stake as a method of punishment for defeated enemies and for the control of their population. The Persians, the Carthaginians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, Egyptians, Macedonians, they were all known for execution on the stake or the cross. But it was the Romans who perfected its use. The Romans would crucify armies soldier by soldier, and they would leave them along the road they traveled through the country, leaving corpses hanging until the buzzards picked them clean for all to see. As an example, in just 20 years or so from the writing of this letter to the Corinthians, the Romans will conquer Jerusalem. And it said they crucified so many people that they ran out of wood for stakes. They, of course, were known for crucifixion of criminals and political enemies. And so we should understand that in this Roman city of Corinth, the message of the cross was one of defeat, punishment, humiliation to those who are perishing. So Paul, to witness Yeshua's death as a victory over sin and this world in the lives of men, and for them to witness Yeshua's death as a sacrifice for the world was foolishness. Because to those who are perishing, the message of the cross was defeat and humiliation. And it's foolishness to those who are perishing today. Let's look at this word foolishness for a minute and help us understand what they thought of this message. It means foolishness, silliness. It's actually where we get the word moron from. And so to those who are perishing, the message of the cross is for morons. How can the death of one man bring about victory for the entire creation? We've seen armies on stakes lining the roads for miles in defeat. For those who are perishing, only a moron could believe such a thing. And Paul is saying that the world looks at us as morons. To those of the world, the message of the cross is an offense. It's offensive. It goes against all they have learned in life. You know, some of us might remember a time before we came to follow Yeshua that someone came to witness to us the death and resurrection of Yeshua and are thinking, how stupid can this person be? But thank God that he later touched us and made us realize the error of our understanding. And that's what Paul is saying to the world, to those who are perishing, the message of the cross is stupidity, moronic, silly. But for us who are being saved, if we've had that moment of being forgiven through Yeshua, it's the power of God. And it's the power of God bringing salvation to those who believe. And we know that because in the moment of our crying out to Yeshua in desperation, he touched us and let us know that we've been forgiven and all will be well with us. We should note here that Paul sees people in one of two groups, those who are being saved and those who are perishing. And there's one thing, and one thing only separating the two, and that's the death of the Messiah on the cross and his resurrection. Those who are perishing, he further describes in verse 19 and when he says, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the intelligent. To those who think they are wise, think the message of the cross is moronic, it is those who think they are intelligent, those who think the message of the cross is moronic, they are those who will perish. Paul actually quotes the Septuagint here, Isaiah 29, verse 14. He says, therefore, look, I will proceed to remove this people. I will remove them and destroy the wisdom of the wise and the discernment of the discerning I will hide. I like the way the Targum puts this. It says, behold, I will strike this people with comprehensive strokes, and the wisdom from their wise men shall perish, and the discernment from their understanding shall be hid. So those who think they're wise, those who think they're intelligent, are perishing, and actually because of their wisdom and their understanding, they can't accept this message of the cross. And notice he won't really get to his teaching on knowledge until chapter 8, but really we see him already speaking about it when he says the wise and the intelligent. Verse 20 says, where is the wise one? Where is the Torah scholar? Where is the debater of this age? Hasn't God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Foreseeing that in God's wisdom, the world, through its wisdom, did not know God. God was pleased through the foolishness of the message proclaimed to save those who believe. Paul really covers everyone. He says, where is the wise one? Covering all those who think of themselves as wise. And then he says, Torah scholar or scribe, Jewish men who copied the Torah scrolls, who literally knew the Torah letter for letter, and were considered experts in the law, those who were wise in their eyes in the Torah. But then he says debater, and the Greek there means a sophist. And a sophist is a paid teacher of philosophy and rhetoric in ancient Greece, who treated everything with skepticism and giving misleading arguments. They are the ones who listen to what is said first, never contributing something to first, but listening and then begin a series of arguments to disprove what is said. We all know people like that. There's people like that today. So Paul covers the whole of those who think they are wise in their human strength. And by the time he writes the Colossians about 10 years later, he's really refined this message and warning against these men, where he says in chapter 2, verse 8, he says, see that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception according to the tradition of men, the basic principles of the world rather than Messiah. For all the fullness of deity lives bodily in him, and in him you have been filled to fullness. And Paul plays no favorites. He includes the wise ones, the scribes, the debaters, all for whom the message of the cross is foolishness. And in verse 21 he says, for seeing that in God's wisdom, the world through its wisdom did not know God, God was pleased through the foolishness of the message proclaimed to save those who believe. For the Jewish people ask for a sign, and the Greek people seek after wisdom. Again, here Paul divides people into two groups. Those who don't accept the message of the cross. The Jewish people, he says, looking for a sign. But you know something? Signs aren't accepted. If signs were accepted, we wouldn't read Numbers chapter 14, 11. And Adonai said to Moses, how long will these people treat me contemptibly? How long will they neglect to trust in me despite the miraculous signs I performed among them? Read of the miraculous signs that God did for Israel. And it doesn't help them in the wilderness, making their decisions in the wilderness, because they fell in the wilderness for making the wrong decisions. Yeshua says this, then some Torah scholars and Pharisees answered him, teacher, we want to see a sign from you. But Yeshua replied to them, an evil and adulterous generation clamors for a sign, yet no sign shall be given to it except the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was in the belly of the great fish for 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights. Again, after the sign was given, Yeshua rose from the ground after 3 days and three nights. They didn't believe. While we ask for signs, our short memories actually diminish signs. You see, while Yeshua said the only sign that will be given you will be the Son of Man in the heart of the earth, the truth is Yeshua presented sign after sign to the people, turning water to wine, raising Lazarus from the dead, giving sight to a man who was blind from birth, something that was never seen in Israel. And yet after being resurrected 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth, the memory of him and the message of the cross is still foolish to those who ask for a sign. And then he says the Greek, seek after wisdom. Now again, wisdom is something that we can't be certain that Paul is, in fact I'm certain he's probably not referring to Gnosticism here, but he's simply referring to the Greeks' philosophy. And the fact that the Greeks seek wisdom, but it's going to play in the hands of the Gnostics in years to come. Just a quick explanation of why I say that. Wisdom in the Greek is Sophia. And for the Gnostics, Sophia was one of the heavenly beings. She fell from the heavens. I'm not sure which level she was at when she fell, but she was one in the upper levels of heaven and fell from the heavens. And when she fell, she was divided into sparks and became captive in the material world. Some of the sparks were captive within human beings. And so some human beings, have this spark of Sophia. And the goal for the Gnostics will be to return the sparks within us to their idea of heaven. But there's a problem. Nobody knows how to accomplish this. And so in the Christian form of Gnosticism, it was Yeshua who came with the knowledge of how to do that. He came to teach those with the spark of Sophia to return to the heavens. And we saw that in the one verse I read from the Gospel of Thomas. And so again, as I said earlier, it was not Yeshua's death and resurrection that saves you. No, it's knowledge that he brought. The point being, the Greeks seek after wisdom. And so they're going to be prone to being deceived by the teaching of these who are preaching knowledge. Now, as I said, we can't be sure that Paul is referring to what will become Gnosticism here, but we can see how the Greeks are going to be susceptible to this and how it's going to grow in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries. But let's be real. The ancient Greeks are not the only ones who are attracted to secret knowledge or mysteries. Just ask yourself, what's the first book Christians are attracted to after being saved or born again, whichever you prefer? What's the first book? Revelation, right? Everybody wants to know Revelation. We all want to know the mysteries and what is to come. However, Paul here is pointing to the gospel. No mystery, just simple foolishness to some, but the power of God unto salvation for those who accept the invitation. So Paul goes on, and he says in verse 23, but we proclaim Messiah crucified, a stumbling block to the Jewish people and foolishness to the Gentile people. But to those who are called, both Jewish and Greek, Messiah is the power of God and the wisdom of God. Those who are called, both Jew and non-Jew. And I was thinking about this week. This is always the word here, the Greek word is kletos, and it means called, but it also means invited. And I think that we should have translated this word invited rather than called. You know, there's a debate in the church of a predestination. Are we predestined by God to receive eternal life? I think, in part, it's because of this word kletos and the way it's translated, called. I think it should have been invited. You see, the whole world has been invited. The good news has gone out to the world. Granted, in some instances it was distorted, but nonetheless, the message of Yeshua or Jesus has gone out to the whole world. I mean, even Muhammad had experience with Christians and heard the good news in some form. The point being, there's an invitation that has gone out. However few accept the message of the cross, that invitation takes some measure of acceptance. And with that measure of acceptance, the door is open for the Spirit of God and the Ruach and the power of God to come into your life, the wisdom of God. Verse 25 says, "For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For you see your calling, brothers and sisters, that not many are wise according to human standards, not many powerful, and not many born well." So finally, he kind of strays away from the rhetoric that we've been going through. And he asked the Corinthians to remember where they were in the condition of their lives when they had originally received Yeshua. That's something I think about at least once a week. And he tells them, brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were invited and you accepted the message. You were not wise by the standards of the age. You were not powerful by the standards of the age. You were not of noble birth, and yet God in his wisdom invited you. It's not because of your status, your wisdom, your knowledge that you received the message, but faith and trust, because you are weak and not wise. He goes on and he says this, "Yet God chose the foolish things of the world so he might put to shame the wise, and God chose the weak things of the world so he might put to shame the strong, and God chose the lowly and despised things of the world, the things that are as nothing, so he might bring to nothing the things that are, so that no human being might boast before God." I don't know how you read this, but it seems to me that he's calling the Corinthians that he just told to remember what they were when God invited them, that he's calling them weak, lowly, despised, so that no man may boast before God. You know, there's a day coming when each of us is going to stand before God. And here's a piece of advice for you. Don't on that day speak about what you've done. Yeshua speaks of those who stand before him and declare what they've done. In Matthew chapter 7, he says, "Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, drive out demons in your name, perform miracles in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Get away from me, you workers of lawlessness." So you don't want to stand before him one day and blow your horn on that day. What you want to do is you want to remember what you were when you were invited and recount what Yeshua has done for you and be praised and thankful to him for what he's done for you. The chapter closes this way. I'll be glad to get out of this chapter with all of his rhetoric. "But because of him, you are in Messiah Yeshua, who became to us wisdom from God and righteousness and holiness and redemption, so that, just as it is written, let him who boasts in Adonai." And so that's the end of chapter 1, and let's be those who boast in Adonai.